It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why smoking is still a big problem for people with lower income and education levels, while overall smoking levels are going down. First, it's time for a weekly look at the latest news in national politics. And one of the biggest stories of the week was in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, where a special election was held for a House seat. If you have any thoughts on that special election and its turnout, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Yoni Applebaum joins us now. He's a senior editor for politics at The Atlantic. Yoni, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's nice to be with you again.
Well, this is just one seat, this Georgia 6th District seat. Why did it become such a big deal?
Well, everybody is looking for indications of where the country's headed. I think the election in November surprised both supporters and opponents of President Trump. And Democrats hoped to pick up a seat here and to send a clear message that voters were rejecting the Republican agenda in Congress and in the White House. And instead, a solidly Republican district rallied to elect a Republican.
We've seen some other special elections that were real long shots for Democrats, and Democrats came out and said, no, we didn't win, but look at how close it was. This was a good sign of things to come. It doesn't seem like they're saying that as much in this particular election.
Well, it's an interesting expectations game here. This was the most expensive race for Congress ever, and I think Democrats really got their hopes up after Ossoff performed well in the preliminary election. On the other hand, his performance last night was broadly consistent. Most of the special elections we've seen have ranged from 6 to 12% Democratic overperformance relative to the baseline. He was in that range. He ran, by most accounts, a fairly good race. He had an army of thousands of energized volunteers. And so you can look at this race and say Democrats are well positioned for 2018, or you can look at it and say, well, this is the fourth special election in rapid succession where Democrats have hoped to flip a district and fallen short.
What do we know about this district, and what is it about this district that made it seem like it was a possibility for Democrats to turn what had been a traditionally Republican stronghold into maybe a Democratic win?
One thing we saw in November was that white college-educated women who have long been a reliable Republican constituency, voting for a string of Republican presidential candidates by a decent margin, moved away from Donald Trump and from the Republican Party. And in general, affluent educated professionals were quite skeptical of Donald Trump. This, of all the congressional districts out there, this is the most heavily college-educated district that a Democrat does not currently represent. So to the extent that we are witnessing a national realignment, this is one place you'd expect that to come through. And I think the results were disappointing to Democrats because these were voters that hoped to persuade that Donald Trump was too crass, too unreliable, not fit or suitable for office, that the Republican agenda was out of line with their values. And instead, the results last night indicated that reliably Republican voters are willing to overlook what they've told pollsters are Trump's sins, but still tend to feel that their Republicans pose less of a threat to their values and way of life than sending a Democrat to put the Democrats back in the majority.
Republicans had been hitting the point that the Democratic candidate didn't actually live in the district, couldn't vote there, and some Democrats and the recriminations now are pointing that out. Did this end up coming down to more local issues like that instead of the nationalized issues?
Look, I mean, Tip O'Neill's famous dictum that all politics is local applies. Certainly, if the Democrats had to do it over, that they might well have chosen a candidate who was had more of a track record of holding public office. At the time that Ossoff jumped into this race, the landscape looked very different, and those sorts of candidates were less interested. But there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking after a race like this, and for the most part, I think people think he ran actually a fairly decent race. You might have been able to pick up the seat if you were a Democrat with a different candidate, but this was about local issues and about the candidates, to be sure. But by the time you're pouring tens of millions of dollars into a district, it really did become, to some substantial extent, a referendum on the Trump presidency. And Trump won that referendum.
Talking to Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic, looking at some of the top national news stories of the week. Let's go a little closer to Washington, D.C. now. The Affordable Care Act repeal. Senate Republicans pushing toward a health care vote. They're saying by late next week is the expectation that, yeah, they'll in fact have a bill and a vote on their timeline?
Well, they say they'll show us the bill tomorrow, and then they'll vote on it by next Thursday. I think the expectation is that we're going to see a bill. What's in it is not entirely clear as yet, perhaps even to the people who are drafting it, and whether or not they actually have the votes necessary to pass it remains unclear. One thing I'd caution, though, is don't use the word repeal. The man who coined the phrase repeal and replace, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has stopped saying that he's going to repeal Obamacare. Instead, he's talking about changing it, altering it. And fundamentally, both the House bill and perhaps, based on what we're hearing, to an even greater extent, the Senate bill, amount to stripping out crucial features of Obamacare in ways that will have broad-ranging impacts on the lives of ordinary Americans. But they do not amount to repealing the fundamental framework of Obamacare. That seems to be something that both the House and the Senate have, at least for now, abandoned.
There's been, as you mentioned, a lot of concern over the process here. On Monday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer questioned Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell about the process and the timing of the Republican Senate health care bill. Here's a listen.
Will we have time, more than 10 hours, since this is a complicated bill, to review the bill? Will it be available to us and the public more than 10 hours before we have to vote for it? Since our leader has said, our Republican leader, that there'll be plenty of time for a process where people can make amendments, you need time to prepare those amendments.
I think we'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
Will it be more than 10 hours?
We'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
I rest my case.
So what are we looking at between now and next Thursday as far as a timeline from what we know?
Well, I think that what we know is what McConnell has told us thus far, and the senator has been notably circumspect. We'll get, at the very least, an outline of the bill tomorrow. We may get the full legislative language. I think that's the likeliest thing to emerge. There will then be a frenzied few days in which people are trying to digest it, and then it'll move to a vote. One thing to bear in mind here is that two things are simultaneously true. The Senate and Congress in general have been sliding in this direction for a couple of decades now, increasingly trying to hack the legislative system in ways that subvert the ordinary process in order to get things done. That's true, and it's also true that it's never been done quite like this, or at least not in a century or more. So the Democratic complaints about the secrecy here are well-founded, but also build on a long-term trend within the Senate where the legislative process is now so dysfunctional and opposition so entrenched to any substantive changes that both Republicans and Democrats in recent years have resorted to extraordinary procedures in order to try to get legislation through the chamber.
And part of that procedure in this case is doing this in a way that requires just 51 votes instead of a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority. The Republicans need pretty much all the Republicans, or just about all the Republicans, to vote in favor of this to get this through. Does it look like it's likely that there will be defectors on the Republican side?
Well, McConnell's got two hall passes to hand out here. He can go down from his 52 members. He can let two of them vote against. There's a couple senators from more liberal states who seem inclined to claim them. That may be Susan Collins in Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. Alaska's sort of idiosyncratic on health care. There are also conservative opponents of this bill. And so what we're going to see over the next week is an elaborate dance as people lodging principal conservative objections to this legislation, often feeling that it doesn't go far enough, will try to move the bill in their direction, and McConnell will try to accommodate them without losing some of his more liberal members in the process. That's going to be a really difficult and delicate balancing act for the Republican majority in the Senate, and it's not entirely clear whether they can pull it off.
Yoni Applebaum is with us, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic, looking at some of the top political stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democrats have a shot at a comeback in 2018, especially in congressional elections? Or will they see more losses like yesterday's special election in Georgia? What do you think of Republican plans to change the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? Do you think they'll be able to come to an agreement? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm picking up the conversation now with Yoni Applebaum, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic, looking at the big stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Call in about the Senate health care plan, special election in Georgia, and the future of congressional elections. And have you been following the White House's daily press briefings when they happen? What do you think of the job Sean Spicer has done? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller now. Mary is with us in Chippewa Falls. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Mary?
Well, I just wanted to make the comment about the Georgia election. I'm a Democrat, so I'm coming from the point of view of someone who would like a Democrat to be elected an additional seat to the House of Representatives. But I'm wondering where this framework came from, that this particular election was somehow this huge milestone or marker or humiliated defeat of the Democrats. It was always going to be a close race. There was no real reason to think that the Democrats were going to win, even though they poured an enormous amount of money into the race. And I just think that, you know, as an outsider, I understand when you're in a race, you're in Georgia, you're a Democrat, I understand getting, you know, that energy going. That goes with any type of political race. But I don't understand where this external in the media, everybody is like seeing this as a litmus test, and that somehow the Democrats have experienced this humiliating defeat. I think it's really dangerous to put it in those terms.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get Yoni in on this. And Yoni, this was coming from the media, but also from the Republicans and from the Democrats around the country.
Yeah, I'd actually say it's an interpretation that I've heard more often from Democratic operatives than from reporters. This is, you know, the Ossoff's performance, you would guess, just a generic Democrat in that district in a generic year would have polled at about 42%. He came in at about 48%. So although he lost, his performance last night suggests a very favorable national landscape for Democrats, and that's something that they can really take heart in. But many Democrats are tremendously frustrated by the Trump administration, by the effort to substantially trim Obamacare, and by the Republican agenda in Congress. Republicans have appointed their justice now to the Supreme Court after blocking Obama's pick. They control the White House and they control Congress. And very few Democrats are inclined to wait until 2018 to fight back. And so even races which would be very difficult for Democrats to win are getting freighted within the party with tremendous importance because they're looking for those hopeful signs. They're looking to send a message to vulnerable Republicans in Congress about the agenda that they're pushing, and they're trying to suggest that it's unpopular with voters. And we overperformed by 6 points, but lost is a more difficult message to send to Republicans who they're trying to warn than, look, this should have been a safe Republican seat and the Democrat picked it up.
Mary, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Julie on the line in Oshkosh. Julie, hi.
Hello. I was calling because I have heard nothing about how the changes to the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid would affect the core population of Medicaid, the people on SSI, elderly, you know, very low-income children. I have a son who is on SSI with an income of $800 a month. He will not have money for a health savings account or, you know, there's no extra funds there to pay a higher premium They talk about ending substance abuse and mental health counseling. Well, some people are on disability for mental health reasons.
Julie, thanks for the call. And Yoni, we don't know all the details of what's coming out of the Senate. It sounds like Julie's asking about people who might have been covered under Medicaid even before the Affordable Care Act came into effect. Do we know what the Senate plan is considering with that anyway?
You know, there have been conflicting reports. There are reports today, which I haven't personally been able to confirm, that it would apply to existing enrollees, which is not the case in the House bill. I don't want to feed the rumor mill here. I think one reason that there's so much frustration that this bill is not already public, that it has not gone through the ordinary process of committee hearings, is that for millions and millions of Americans, this is intensely personal. This is about their loved ones. It's about their families. And whether they support or oppose these changes, they're going to be impacted by them. They want a chance to let their members of Congress know about the impact of the legislation they'll be voting on. And they feel cheated out of the chance to do that because the bill has not been publicly debated before being rushed toward passage. And I think that your caller expresses that well, that the stakes here could not be higher. And whether you think these ideas are good reforms and much needed, or whether you think that they're terrible ideas, you really don't have a chance right now to call up your senator and let them know how you feel about them, because neither you or probably your senator knows what's in the bill.
Julie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at the top stories in national politics now with Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic. Let's turn to a national story that's also a Wisconsin story. House Speaker Paul Ryan has a new challenger, Randy Bryce, an iron worker from Wisconsin, released an ad that's making the rounds now, critical of Paul Ryan's health care plans. Here's a listen.
I could do so much more, and I will do so much more, taking my voice, taking our voice, and what we need to Washington, D.C. I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person.
So Paul Ryan has low approval ratings right now, but he seems to keep handily winning elections, whether it's a primary challenge or a runoff. Is there any perception that Paul Ryan might be vulnerable next year, Yoni?
Well, I think next year is still a long ways away. This is a candidate who's twice run for office at the state legislative level and twice lost. Paul Ryan has a long track record of success and of delivering for his district, and that makes him a tough incumbent to knock off. But this is, these special elections are indicating that the national landscape has tilted away from Republicans. And even with gerrymandered legislative districts and the general urban concentration of Democrats, two features of the landscape that really do favor Republicans, seats that would ordinarily be quite safe, like Paul Ryan's, are suddenly more vulnerable. And there's some optimism among Democrats that a candidate like this can appeal to swing voters in that district. And part of the appeal here would be not just ordinary blue-collar working guy running against a Washington insider. It'd be the posture of the outsider. It's one thing we know from polling that really fueled Donald Trump's rise was the perception voters had that he wasn't part of the system. If Democrats, talking to party strategists, one of their key priorities for 2018 is recruiting candidates like this who can go to the electorate and say, hey, I'm not part of the system. Vote for me if you want change. And voters have a tremendous hunger for change.
Let's take a look at a story out of the White House now. Sean Spicer has been making fewer appearances at White House press briefings. Some people drawing attention to that. Fewer public press briefings from the president himself. Then a Sean Spicer no cameras, no recording conference, and then finally a normal one. What have we heard from the White House about their accessibility to the media?
Well, my colleague Rosie Gray asked Steve Bannon, the advisor to the president, about this, and he texted back, Sean got fatter. I don't think that's actually a plausible explanation for why they've curtailed press briefings, but I think it does reveal the general attitude of the White House toward the press corps. It's under no obligation to answer its questions, and that in general this is a White House which has doubled down hard on secrecy. that's something the last several presidents have done, but this administration has taken its secrecy and lack of transparency to really new extremes, and its hostility to the press. It openly flaunts and frankly tries to antagonize the press at times and to have public performative battles with the press because it's convinced that plays to its political advantage, that any time the media is a convenient whipping boy. It's one of the few institutions that may be less popular than the White House itself.
Are these White House briefings in the Trump administration or before useful? Do we actually get useful information out of them ever?
You know, the reason they've been conducted all these years is not out of some general sense of civic obligation. They're an opportunity for the president and his team to deliver their message to the press corps and through the press corps to the broader public. They've shifted since they've started to be broadcast as well as providing the gist for written stories, and they've shifted again more recently in the last decade or two as larger and larger audiences have started streaming them, as the cable networks have started carrying them live. And now they are, to some extent, performance vehicles. What they do, I think, is make it clear when the White House will and will not answer questions. That's one value they really do deliver to ordinary Americans. When there is something the White House would rather not address, and several reporters ask the press secretary about it, and he or she refuses to answer that question straightforwardly, that can be tremendously valuable. There's an accountability mechanism built into that. At the same time, we shouldn't be naive about this. The only reason they've happened this long is that administrations have been convinced that they generally work to their advantage. The Trump administration seems not similarly convinced that that's the case, and so it's trying its best to downplay them or to move them to venues and formats that will not provide the same degree of public interest.
Briefly on that metric of how often the White House spokesperson directly answers a question, how has Sean Spicer done on that measure?
I think even by the standards of a job not known for forthright communication, I mean, it's not as if previous press secretaries have been great answering questions. Sean Spicer has raised the non-answer to an art.
Yoni, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, always a pleasure.
That was Yoni Applebaum, senior editor for politics at The Atlantic. He joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.